Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Robin Young, it's Here and Now. At least two congressional committees are now investigating claims that could change the view of U.S. intelligence failures before the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Republican Congressman Kurt Weldon, citing an unnamed intelligence official, told the New York Times and this program yesterday that U.S. military intelligence agents identified Mohammed Atta and three other 9/11 hijackers more than a year before the attacks. But he said the agents were legally blocked from sharing that information with law enforcement.
For two reasons, allegedly because of Mohammed Atta having a green card, and secondarily because of the lawyers in the administration at the time, fearful of the fallout because of what happened at Waco with the Branch Davidians. The Special Forces Command were told they could not talk to the FBI.
Today, some members of the 9/11 Commission are questioning why they didn't know about this intelligence, which apparently was gathered by a secret Pentagon unit known as Able Danger. Well, on the line from Greece is attorney Richard Benveniste, a Democrat and former member of Congress who sat on the 9/11 Commission. Mr. Veniste, how would you characterize these claims?
Well, if in fact they're accurate, if in fact our military operations were aware of the connection between Mohammed Atta and the three others who are named, this would be almost a disgraceful lapse in our intelligence community's ability to protect the United States. Certainly on the underlying question, did we have this information? If that is true, if Mr. Weldon's assertions and those of an as yet unnamed a former member of this Able Danger group are correct, and we did know, that is, our military knew that four of these individuals known to be in the United States were associated with one another and were members of Al-Qaeda, then clearly this information could have been usefully used to prevent the 9/11 catastrophe.
Today, a group of 9/11 widows is calling the commission report incomplete and illusory because of these claims. What's your response?
Well, clearly we did the best we could. The information, to the best of my knowledge, was never provided to us, and that is a second reason for outrage. Why were we not informed of the fact that the military was aware of the interconnections between Atta, Al-Sheke, and the two others who we did know about, Hazmi and Al-Midhar? The two individuals who the FBI knew were in the United States but could not find are now linked to the ringleader, Mohammed Atta, and another of the hijackers, Al-Sheke. If we knew that four individuals were in the United States, members of Al-Qaeda, at a time of unprecedented warning to the United States in the summer of 2001, and still did nothing about it to interrupt what their activities were. We had photographs of them, for goodness sakes. Those could have been simply flashed on television like America's Most Wanted. And one could almost guarantee, knowing how Al-Qaeda works, that they would not have risked getting on those airplanes that day. It's just heartbreaking, if it is correct.
Congressman Weldon's unnamed intelligence agent told reporters that in 2003 he did tell commission staffers about this Able Danger unit and its intelligence, and he says he specifically mentioned Atta's name. Do you think that staffers knew about this?
Well, I find it hard to believe, almost impossible to believe. Our staff made a trip to Afghanistan. They met with this individual. They were, in fact, told about the existence of Able Danger. But they claim, and I have every reason to believe it, that they were never told that Able Danger had Atta under surveillance. If we had known that information, clearly it was explosive. We would have followed it up. Indeed, our staff did make requests for further information about Able Danger when they returned to the United States, and to the best of my knowledge, No such information was contained in that material.
Mm-hmm. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld has suggested that he knew nothing about the Able Danger intelligence gathering program, and a Pentagon spokesperson says they cannot release information about top secret units such as this.
Somebody's going to have to release some information. This will not stand. There will have to be accountability with respect to this. The first question is the information accurate? If that is in fact the case, then there must be accountability as why that information was not reported up the chain.
So asking these questions and finding out if these claims are true, that would be the responsibility of Congress, yes?
Absolutely. Well, it ought to be the responsibility of this administration to come forward with a truthful and candid and prompt answer. The American public deserves it.
Attorney Richard Benveniste is a former member of the National Commission that investigated the terrorist attacks on the United States. He is not a former member of Congress. In the event of a biological attack on American soil, the U.S. is largely unprepared, according to some bioterrorism experts who say the country has lost the momentum to provide an adequate defense. The U.S. Senate is considering what's known as the BioShield 2 Act in response. Among other things, it would encourage drug companies to develop medicines to fight biological attacks. Although the first BioShield Act set aside $5.6 billion for more drug research, so far there has been little movement. Joining us to talk about the threat of bioterrorism and U.S. preparedness is Dr. Tara O'Toole. She's director of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Biosecurity, and she's on the line from her office in Baltimore, Maryland. Welcome, Dr. O'Toole.
Thank you very much.
Can you first of all tell us about this BioShield 2 Act? What would it do, and why do we need it?
This is a bill that's now being thought through and making its way through Congress that would seek to encourage biotech and pharmaceutical companies to develop new drugs against possible bioterrorism agents, new drugs and vaccines. Here's the problem. Pharmaceutical manufacturers are getting out of the vaccine and the antibiotic business because it just doesn't pay compared to what they would earn if they developed a new cancer medicine, for example. You take an antibiotic for 2 weeks and you're done. You take a cancer medicine for much longer, or a chronic disease medicine, something against arthritis, for example, for years and years. So the profits that a company could make developing a cancer medicine outweigh by magnitudes of order what they could make in trying to do the research to develop a new antibiotic. What BioShield is trying to do is entice these companies back into the fray. So it's looking for ways to offset the difference in profits between a chronic disease medicine and the anti-infectives. Some people think we've got to do this for the national defense. Others think it's not worth it, that it's a hidden tax on health, and we ought to just pay for what we need as the Defense Department does. But that's a lot of money. A new drug on average, according to the pharmaceutical industry, cost $1 billion to develop. So the $5.6 billion that is in the first BioShield bill isn't going to go very far. And it is also necessary to consider the potential legal liability that might be associated with a drug that's tested, in effect, for the first time in humans in the middle of a public health emergency. If, for example, we do develop some new vaccine or medicine and we have to use it for the first time after a bioterrorism attack, you're going to be in the position of giving it to millions of people in a life or death situation potentially. And some of those people are invariably going to develop adverse reactions. And the drug companies are worried that, you know, their assets will be held at stake if that's the case. So they're also looking to BioShield 2 for some kind of liability coverage in these special public emergency situations.
How likely do you think it is that we would see a biological attack on this country?
Well, I think it's very likely. I've been working on this topic full-time for 7 years and trying to convince myself that I don't need to worry about it anymore. And the more I analyze it, the more convinced I've become that it's going to happen. Building a biological weapon is not hard, and it's going to get easier. This is one way that an enemy of the United States could really take on the country with a very serious attack without having a military that's nearly as strong as ours. And as science advances, unfortunately, it's going to get easier and easier to make and to distribute a big biological weapon. So I think it's very likely we're going to be experiencing a bioterrorism attack in the next few years. I also think that we have to understand that in the 21st century, the developed world is much more vulnerable to natural epidemics than we have been for quite some time. Because of population pressures and commercial expansion, we're pushing into once remote ecosystems so that we're coming into contact with new viruses and new pathogens, like SARS, for example. And because of the way we travel around the globe these days, those pathogens are going to spread much more quickly than they have in the past. So for reasons beyond bioterrorism, we need to think about how we will deal with epidemics in this world and how we'll save lives and mitigate the kind of disruption that always, throughout history, have been associated with epidemics.
I saw one security official quoted as saying that no community in America is prepared. Would you agree with that?
Well, you can imagine many different kinds of bioterrorism attack scenarios, and some would be like the very small and primitive mailings that we experienced in 2001, which yielded only 22 cases. Not a lot of people were sick or hurt, but that attack certainly caused great havoc. If you're talking about a series of anthrax attacks delivered through the air, aerosolized attacks, or even a medium-sized attack on an American city with aerosolized anthrax, that is probably something that no city in America could handle today. And it's quite feasible, at least for me, to imagine an attack that would basically, bring most of what we regard as normal life in America to a grinding halt. Unless we had the medicines and the vaccines and the logistical preparations to deal with it very quickly.
It's my understanding that since September 11th, there has been an effort to stockpile some drugs and vaccines for things like anthrax. Are folks being inoculated now to prepare for a possible attack? Can that even be done?
No, nobody is being vaccinated now. There was an attempt before the Iraq War to vaccinate healthcare workers and other first responders against smallpox. The goal was to vaccinate 500,000 people. Only 38,000 ended up being vaccinated for a variety of reasons, including health professional skepticism about whether there was a real threat, worries about whether the vaccine was safe, and a lot of operational problems as to how to actually get people vaccinated. Some people think it would be a good idea to vaccinate ahead of time against anthrax, for example, but right now we only have a couple of million doses of anthrax vaccine, so it's not a realistic option.
So our stockpiles aren't where they should be?
Not yet. Mm-hmm. We're much better off than we were in 2001, but we need more than we have.
We're talking with Dr. Tara O'Toole. She's director of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Biosecurity about what the U.S. is prepared to do if terrorists unleash a biological weapon. When we come back, we ask who's in charge of biosecurity in the government. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Here and now. We're talking with Dr. Tara O'Toole, director of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Biosecurity. She's an expert on bioterrorism and what the United States has done to prepare for a possible biological strike. Dr. O'Toole, we understand that the U.S. is now working to build up the national stockpile of vaccines and antibiotics, but can you tell us how the federal government would disseminate those medicines?
Well, the federal government says it can get components of the national stockpile to any community in America within 8 hours, and that's probably true. They've tested that on a number of occasions. The trick then is to break down this large plane load worth of stuff into packets that can be efficiently distributed to individuals, and no city has yet devised a plan for doing that very effectively. There's a lot of proposals out there. Public health agencies have put together plans to set up clinics and distributing centers throughout the city. Doing that requires an awful lot of people, and a lot of logistical hurdles have to be overcome. There's been talk of using the Postal Service to deliver medicines to people's doors. There's problems with that, including the fact that the Postal Service hasn't signed on to that plan yet. Another way to think about it is to use the systems we rely on in normal times to see if we could encourage pharmacies and big supermarket chains, for example, or the discount stores where many people already get their flu shot, to participate in a government program to distribute the stockpile. There's no real good plan right now, but a lot of people are thinking about this. I think it's time to kind of think out of the box and figure out how we can use the private sector, which has its own distribution systems, which work quite well in normal times.
But it would seem that we've been talking about this for 4 years now almost.
Yeah.
Why is it only still in these discussion stages, and why don't we have a clear plan?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. Right after 2001, there was a lot of urgency in the government around these issues and a lot of people working on these problems, and a lot of progress was made in about 6 months. And then things kind of went back to business as usual, and there has not been the same aggressive leadership, the same sense of let's do what we need to do and normal process be darned in the government since then. It's very difficult to tell, for example, who's in charge of biodefense in the United States. There's confusion as to whether this is an HHS responsibility or a DHS responsibility. If it belongs to Health and Human Services, who exactly has the authority to make things happen? Things are kind of, you know, settling back or have settled back into a slow bureaucratic pace that doesn't give one a lot of confidence that this is a top priority within the government right now.
I did recently read that Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff said that he was going to put a higher priority on anti-bioterrorism efforts and was naming a chief medical officer to help oversee bioterrorism policy. Do you think that's a step in the right direction?
Yes, I think that's probably a good sign. It caused some confusion because most people who watch these things thought that Health and Human Services was in charge. So there was some confusion as to exactly what this new doctor was going to do. But I think it overall is probably a good thing. We'll have to wait and see.
So what would your message be to government officials about biosecurity preparedness?
Well, we certainly have to figure out how we're going to get what we need in the stockpile, which I think has to include a very ambitious government program to greatly speed up how long it takes to make a drug and how we do that. We have to drive down the costs of drugs so we can afford to get what we need and get it very quickly in times of crisis.
But how do you do that without compromising public safety?
That's a long story, but you get a project going that looks a lot more like the Apollo project than the current BioShield project. And you give pharmaceutical companies and scientists and biotech companies incentives for working together to try and figure out how we could all make drugs a lot faster and cheaper. Everybody has an interest in doing that. And there's a lot of different ways that the problem could be approached. We did something fairly similar some decades ago when we worried that the United States was no longer going to have the edge in making semiconductor chips, and we could do it again for drug manufacture. We also have to figure out how we would take care of the sick in times of a big epidemic, how we would protect the well, including getting the medicines and vaccines before they got sick. And we certainly have to clarify who's in charge at the federal level and make sure they have the authority and the people and the money to do what needs to be done.
Dr. O'Toole, so far the picture you're painting is pretty grim. What, if anything, reassures you that we would be able to deal with a possible biological attack?
Biological science is on the leading edge of a revolution, and I think that will be very helpful. I think the capacity to communicate that has come with the information technologies of the last century gives us the possibility of understanding an epidemic and dealing with it rationally in a way that really was not feasible before, and hopefully enlightened self-interest will lead the United States and others in the developed world to use these technologies in ways that will help not only our own people, but people everywhere. I think, for example, that we could set a goal of eliminating large epidemics of infectious disease within our lifetime, and we could get a lot of people around the world to join us in trying to achieve that goal. You know, half of all the premature mortality in the developing world is from infectious diseases. And that is one of the reasons they're struggling so hard to improve their standard of living. If we could remove that burden from some of these countries, they may have a better chance of transitioning to democracy, and it might discourage would-be terrorists, for that matter.
Are you more reassured or afraid?
I am hopeful. I am anxious, but hopeful.
Dr. O'Toole, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Tara O'Toole is director of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Biosecurity. She spoke with us from her office in Baltimore, Maryland. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we speak with a Palestinian political analyst about Israel's upcoming pullout from the Gaza Strip. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. Robin Young is on vacation. It's Here and Now. This week, President Bush signed into law an energy bill that calls for an increase in the production of oil, gas, and other fuels in an attempt to lessen dependence on foreign energy sources. While the law recognizes the need for alternative energy and subsidizes research to develop such sources, the bulk of the benefits go to older energy sources, such as coal, oil, and nuclear power. One item tucked into the new law is an expansion of daylight saving time. Starting in 2007, daylight saving time would be extended by a month on each end, so clocks would spring forward on the second Sunday in March and fall back on the first Sunday in November. Supporters say this will help save energy, but critics say it will have the opposite effect. Michael Downing, author of the book Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time, spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes, who asked him if daylight saving time has ever saved anything.
It never has. Really, it's a fantastically expensive saving program, but it's a tremendously effective spending program. Really, from the beginning, the people who were behind daylight saving were the retail stores who wanted evening light to get people into the big department stores on their way home from work. Daylight saving has always helped American retailers. It's increased spending. But for 100 years, Congress has been debating the spending program, and it's never turned up a saving.
Now, the argument is that it saves energy because people aren't heating their homes in the dark as much as they are during the waking hours, and it also saves on gasoline. Not true, you say?
Not true. It was a charming theory, the idea that we were sleeping through sunrise, and if we shifted that hour to the evening, we wouldn't turn on reading lights so early in the evening. But here's the deal. First of all, Americans really don't have the same habits they had 100 years ago when this idea came up. We use electricity all day long. So the idea that we're going to save it by moving a particular hour really has never been proven. And though Congress has tried many times to come up with an idea, and we hear our congressman telling us now that we're going to save as much as 100,000 barrels of oil a day, the problem is that daylight saving now turns out maybe to be an energy waster. When you push Americans out of their houses, which is what daylight saving does because we like to go outside when it's light outside, Americans tend to get in their cars. The petroleum industry has known since 1920 that daylight saving actually promotes the use of gasoline.
Take us back a little bit and talk about how daylight savings time came into being in the first place.
It starts in London in 1904 with a man on a horse. William Willett is riding around and he notices everybody in London has their curtains drawn at sunrise. He considers this a tremendous waste of a natural resource. He's the first modern proponent of the idea of shifting the clocks forward to move that hour to the afternoon. The British debate it for 10 years, and then right as World War I breaks out, the Germans, in a kind of sneak attack, adopt daylight saving, and they actually say the British couldn't rouse themselves to a decision. The Germans adopted during World War I, hoping to save energy for the war. Britain and America follow. That's really the rubric under which countries first adopt daylight saving. It's so fantastically unpopular in the United States that before the Congress bothers to sign an actual official end to the war, They repeal the national law on daylight saving. We don't have another national policy until 1966.
There was some suggestion also back then that it would benefit farmers, but farmers were perhaps the biggest critics of the plan.
Farmers hated daylight saving, despite their reputation for loving it. It's one more confusion in the controversy. Here's the deal. Farmers, let's say in 1916, had 3 hours of sunlight in the morning to get their eggs and their produce to markets in the cities. While you take away an hour of morning sunlight, they've got 2 hours to do the same amount of work. Farmers were the principal reason the Congress was afraid to pass a national daylight saving law until 1966.
If it's disliked so much, why does Congress keep pushing it, and why are we accepting it?
Well, it's an interesting question. There are two reasons, really. The first time we get a national law in 1966, it's for uniformity. The only benefit of clock time at all is actually predictability and synchronicity. America's clocks were fantastically out of sync by 1965, and here's why. Cities had adopted daylight saving individually. So by 1965, we have 71 of America's largest cities using daylight saving, 59 not using it. One airline's reporting we're getting 4,000 calls a day from people trying to figure out what time it is in the cities of their destination. The U.S. Naval Observatory says this country is the world's worst timekeeper. So to make a uniform time policy, Congress gives us 6 months of daylight saving time, 6 months of standard time. But then Congress really begins to respond to a particular lobby, and it's the retail lobby. In 1986, we move from 6 to 7 months of daylight saving. Here are the results. For the golf industry alone, that extra hour of evening light is worth $200 to $400 million.
Earlier tea times.
You got that right. And the barbecue industry, $150 million. Convenience stores, $50 million. When we look at the history of this law, we're really not looking at social policy for energy. We're looking at a tremendously effective retail strategy.
In your view, what is the solution? Is there any way to save energy by tinkering with the clock?
I think there isn't. And I think the Department of Transportation, which has done the studies, said as early as 1974 that this is never going to be an effective strategy. There are effective ways to conserve energy. Unfortunately, they tend to require people to make a sacrifice. Congress loves daylight saving because it appears to have no direct cost to the constituent.
Despite all this, there is going to be an expansion under the federal energy bill. Do you think there'll be controversy?
Oh, I think there will always be controversy with daylight saving, and historically we know this. There's very little opposition before it happens, and then when it comes into effect, people who live particularly in the western edge of the time zone, where they get later sunrise times, really do object. This was the history with Richard Nixon's experiment with year-round daylight saving in 74 and 75. No big objection in advance. Within 2 weeks of that plan being enacted, the country went wild. Pictures of children going to school on dark, trafficy streets flashed across the nation. The plan had to be scaled back. But I have to say, the history also tells us we will get more and more and more daylight saving.
Michael Downing is the author of Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time. He teaches creative writing at Tufts University, and he spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. As always, we welcome your thoughts about our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, a labor of love, long gone but not forgotten, we hear how several pipe organs have found their voice again. You're listening to Here and Now. The nation's economy is strong, according to both President Bush and Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. Greenspan cited the improving economy and job growth as reasons why the Federal Reserve should raise a key interest rate to 3.5%, its highest level in 4 years. For some perspective on the economy and what it means, we now turn to Mark Zandi, who's chief economist at economy.com. Hi, Mark.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
Who's going to be affected most by this interest rate hike, do you think?
People who need to borrow money, obviously, are going to have to pay a little bit more in interest to borrow that money. And then people who have already borrowed money and have debt that adjusts with market interest rates, people with adjustable rate mortgages, home equity lines of credit, credit cards, they will start to see payments on those liabilities begin to rise.
Mm-hmm. This is the 10th time in 13 months that interest rates have gone up by the Federal Reserve. We haven't seen much of an effect on the housing market anyway, at least anecdotally. Has it affected the housing market, these increases, incremental increases up to this point?
No, not at all. Lenders have circumvented the rate hikes. Never underestimate the creativity of the American lender. They keep coming up with new and better deals, and that's what they've done. Interest-only adjustable rate mortgages, option arms, just a whole new range of mortgage products have become available that have allowed affordability to remain high despite what the Federal Reserve has done.
Mm-hmm. Because of gas prices, which are skyrocketing, and housing prices, it's hard to believe some of the statements from Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan and President Bush that the economy really is rosy, is it?
It is. You know, the economy is doing very well. Growth is strong. Inflation is low. Interest rates are rising, but they're still low by historical standards. But obviously, the benefits of the strong economy haven't accrued to everyone. Higher income, high net worth households have done very, very well in this economy. Lower income households, lower net worth households haven't done quite as well. And of course, those are the households that are struggling, having to fill their gasoline tank and to meet those higher mortgage payments.
Let's talk about gas prices. They continue to go up. Is that going to sort of trickle down to other areas of the economy, do you think?
Yes, I do think the higher gasoline and more broadly energy prices will begin to weigh on the economy. It hasn't noticeably so far just because of the strong resilience of the economy and broad sources of growth. But at $65 per barrel and with a gallon of gasoline now going for $2.50, I do think that's going to start weighing on economic growth as we make our way into next year, particularly if energy prices don't begin to come down.
The numbers also that we've been seeing on the economy indicate that job growth is strong, but productivity is down. Yes?
Yes. Job growth is very strong. We're creating almost 200,000 jobs per month, which by any standard is very good. Unemployment has fallen. It's down to 5%. But you're right, productivity growth is starting to slow, but it's slowing from a torrid pace, a pace that could not be sustained for very long. And even now with the slowdown, productivity growth is sturdy and solid and should support continued good growth and living standards going forward if we're able to maintain it.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the economy and you hear these rosy predictions, do you see any dark clouds at all?
Well, there are a few. The energy prices we've discussed are a problem. And I do think what's going on in the housing market is a growing issue. There is speculation creeping into markets all across the country, in your backyard in Boston and New York and Florida and California and parts of the Mountain West. We are seeing lots of investors and lots of speculation. And as interest rates rise, I do suspect we'll see some weakening in housing. I don't think the bubble will burst, but it will certainly deflate. And under some scenarios, if interest rates were to spike for whatever reason, that would be very hard on these investors, on housing broadly and on the broader economy. So that is a growing threat, particularly if housing doesn't soon cool.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, it looks as if the Fed may raise interest rates even more in the future, yes?
They will. As long as the economy continues to grow at this pace, they'll continue to tighten policy. As long as the housing market remains as strong as it is, they'll continue to tighten policy. And the script says they'll tighten through the end of this year into next, and I think they'll stick to that script.
All right. Well, Mark, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
Mark Zandi is chief economist at economy.com. Stay with us. There is more ahead, here and now. Thank you. Here and Now. President Bush took a break from his ranch today to go to Illinois and sign into law a massive transportation bill. The president ventured from Texas to Montgomery, Illinois, which is in House Speaker Dennis Hastert's district. It's also home to a plant operated by Caterpillar, the company that makes heavy equipment for transportation projects. The president said this measure is going to be good for the economy.
If we want people working in America, we got to make sure our highways and roads are modern. We got to bring up this transportation system into the 21st century. I mean, you can't expect your farmers to be able to get goods to market if we don't have a good road system. You can't expect to get these Caterpillar products all around the United States if we don't have a good road system. This road system that we have is going to be modernized through the Transportation Equity Act. It provides more than $286 billion over 6 years to upgrade our nation's network of roads and bridges and mass transit systems. The Transportation Act will finance needed road improvements and will ease traffic congestion in communities all across this country.
The watchdog group Taxpayers for Common Sense says the law is bloated and expensive. The group's Keith Ashdown says it's based more on political clout than transportation needs. He points to Alaska. Although it's the third least populated state, it got the fourth most money for special projects, thanks to its only congressman, House Transportation Committee Chair Don Young. One of those special projects in Alaska is a bridge near Anchorage to be named Don Young's Way. The pipe organ appears to be making a comeback. In some parts of the Midwestern United States, organists are holding a series of free concerts known as Pipe Organ Encounter 2005. In Massachusetts, some 300 people recently attended a convention of the Organ Historical Society in an effort to save the pipe organ in the area. Reporter Keith O'Brien has our story.
That was E-flat.
In an empty church in New Bedford, Massachusetts, Bruce Garzina and Richard Hill fumbled with the keys of a 130-year-old pipe organ, trying to find its perfect sound.
It's the E-flat.
It was hard to capture. 30 years of inactivity will do that to an organ, and this one had been in ruins for decades.
Yeah.
By the time Garzina began working on it last year, the valves were rotten, entire notes gone, and the organ had visitors. Bats were living in its pipes.
Back in around 1970, the tower leaked, filled with water, and hundreds of gallons of water poured down on top of the organ and silenced it, and it hasn't been playing ever since.
But Garzina was patient. This wasn't just any old organ. He determined this was the 1876 Hillborn Roosevelt that had graced Trinity Church in Boston at its grand opening. It had been made, Garzina said, to impress, to blow the roof off Trinity Church. How it ended up here, at a small church in New Bedford, far south of the Boston Route 128 Beltway, he didn't know. Pipe organs, monumental though they may be, have a way of disappearing and reappearing like that.
Well, I couldn't really believe it at first. You know, I was astounded that, you know, we had this Hillborn Roosevelt organ right here in New Bedford. In 1927, when E.M. Skinner built the new organ for Trinity Boston, all further information on where it went or what happened to it is just kind of lost. Well, what happened is it went south of 128, and when that happens, it's lost. It falls off the edge of the earth. And so here it is.
Found now, the organ has been restored, or as Garzina likes to say, resurrected. This is what organ lovers do. They rescue that which others have forgotten, taken for granted, or literally kicked to the curb. And this is the payoff. Mid to late 1800s, Boston was a hub of organ building as local organ companies churned out some of the best organs ever made. There were many names behind these instruments, but few bigger than brothers Elias and George Greenleaf Hook, known as E and G.G. Hook. They're still revered today for their work. John Bishop of the Organ Clearinghouse in Lexington, Massachusetts.
The quality of the materials they used, the way they finished the wood, the accuracy of their markings, you can see there. Pencil marked on the wood on the inside of the organ. It's even impressive how sharp they got their pencils.
Hook organs are still around. Most recently, Bishop placed one at the nearby First Parish Church in Needham. It was, in many ways, your typical organ rescue. Bishop's people found the organ at a soon-to-be-closed church in Pennsylvania, dismantled it, and shipped it to Needham. But mysteries still remain.
It was built for the Episcopal Church in Moravia, New York. And there's an inscription on the back of the organ in pencil that indicates that it was moved from that church in 1934. I'm not sure where it was taken at that point.
Bishop would like to know. Organ lovers want to know everything about these instruments, where they were played and when and by whom and who built them and where they were first installed.
My name is Richard Hill, and I'm a retired school teacher. I came from a musical family. My mother was a soprano soloist at the Winthrop Street Baptist Church here in Taunton. And my Sunday mornings as an infant were spent in the choir loft.
When Hill, now 66, was old enough to see across the pedal board of the organ in that loft, he knew he wanted to play the instrument. It was just in him. And thus began a half century of pulling out all the stops, the organ stops, the knobs and organist pulls to turn air into music, like the open diapason stop. And the 8-foot trumpet stop. And Hill's favorite stop of them all.
Listen to this doppel flute. It's a very, very rich sound, isn't it?
Organists like to say that pipe organs don't just make sounds. They sing with their own voices. So when an old organ is lost, like the 1859 Hook destroyed in a Boston church fire last January, they mourn it as if it were a friend. Phyllis Masurlian, who was baptized in 1940 in the church, remembers watching it burn, the cold, the darkness, the flames shooting through the roof.
It was terrible to watch it, and of course I kept hoping that corner with the organ would be saved. If I had the choice, say one thing in the church, I would say, save the organ.
Most organs, however, don't burn up. They just fade away. That's why in New Bedford, Bruce Garzina was so intent on saving the old Trinity Church organ. Garzina estimated that he worked 600 hours at no charge to revive the instrument, but he was still troubled that it wasn't perfect for its big recital during the convention of the Organ Historical Society. Richard Hill told him not to worry. Surely long ago this organ played big shows. It was built, after all, to impress. And Hill believes that the organ, once lost and now found, would rise to the occasion again.
Our visit with members of the Organ Historical Society was reported by Keith O'Brien. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker.